Blog Talk Radio.
From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is June 12th, 2011. It's a beautiful spring day up here in the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska, a beautiful 52 degrees. It looks like we may have some rain for the first few times of the spring, and hopefully it holds off a little while so we can get out there and do some stuff up here in Alaska. On the other line, we have our co-host calling in from Denver. Michelle, are you there?
I am.
How is it going in Denver?
You know, it's been very nice. We have our typical afternoon storms, but Denver is a lively, bustling city with a lot of travelers and a lot of art shows going on right now.
So what's going on at Denver Dog Works here in the early summer, end of spring, early summer?
Well, at Denver Dog Works, we are trying to expand our therapy dog training program. We are also in the works to expand our availability for private lessons, both in-home and at our training center. We're one of the few dog training companies in Denver that is not a franchise, that does not offer solely in-home training. We have the ability to do training at our training center in-home. We have the ability to do board and train programs that encompass both being at a kennel and inside of our home at the same time. So we have a lot of different training opportunities for your dog, but for the most part, our dog training style and approach comes down to what you would do with your dog if you had this as a job 24/7, and that's the beauty behind our programs.
Well, you know, today we have an accomplished author and a dog trainer herself. Her name is Jordan Taylor, and she wrote a book called Wonder Dogs. It's 101 German Shepherd Dog Films, and I know we have a German Shepherd named Kane. He's a three-year-old German Shepherd that is 100% energy, 100% drive. He is going 24 hours a day, and maybe we can get some questions and comments, because it looks like Jordan knows what she's talking about in terms of German Shepherds. Jordan, are you there?
I'm here.
And you are calling in from Washington today. Whereabouts do you live up there in the Pacific Northwest?
I am outside of Seattle on Bainbridge Island, which is in the Puget Sound.
Yeah, that's a beautiful area. I went to college in Portland, and my wife and I were just up there this past February. And man, I tell you what, you guys have a great place to live up there in Seattle. You know, so many people talk about it always rains up there. But, you know, I lived in Portland, and I never owned an umbrella. So how do you guys get along in terms of doing dog training in areas where the weather's kind of nasty all the time?
We have a lot of indoor facilities. You see a lot of arenas being used, a lot of horse facilities being used, indoor buildings, fairgrounds. And we do get to work outside in the summer. We do have a beautiful summer, but rain is a concern here.
Do you guys have a lot of dog parks up there or no?
Back and forth. When you get more into the cities, there are a lot of parks in Seattle. The further out you get, we have a lot of wooded areas, a lot of hiking trails, where you don't see a lot of fenced-in dog parks because people are very free to have their dogs out and with them, either on retractable leashes or in some cases off-leash, some cases just under voice command, and also just on leash. There are so many hiking and walking opportunities around us in the Olympics and the Cascades.
So you are a dog trainer, you're an author, and you also train dogs for shows, movies, and plays, and that sort of thing.
That's
how
right.
did you get, before we get into talking about your book and things, how did you get started in that?
That was something that I always wanted to do. As a child, I was very much the dog person, always wanted the dog, be with the dog, pretend I was a dog. And I wanted to be a trainer. People would say to me, oh, are you going to be a vet? And I was not into the vet thing. I didn't want my interaction with the dogs to be something that was stressful for them, or thinking, you know, about the diseases and injuries and working with traumatized animals. Not that I have anything against vets. Vets are fantastic, and I wouldn't have my pets without them. But it was not for me, and I kept looking at alternatives and just started feeling more and more that the training was something I wanted to be a part of. And training specifically for films came from the combination of the love of dogs and the love of movies and shows. I grew up watching TV shows like Wishbone and reruns of Lassie, and I was always thinking, there's somebody behind that camera. There's somebody telling that dog what to do. The dog doesn't get up and go to work by itself every day.
Right.
And so it was just that combination love that propelled my education in that direction to work with the film dogs. And it's been a really interesting and fun process to learn that side of the business.
So based up in Seattle, how do you train dogs for film, you know, up there, I don't know, 2,000 miles from L.A.? How does that
far
work
from
for
Hollywood?
You? Yes.
We get a lot of independent filmmakers up here. There's a pretty big film industry in Portland and Seattle. And, of course, in Canada, when you go up to Canada, they have all the tax rebates. There's a lot of emphasis for filmmakers up there. And so you get that cross-section of people who are going back and forth between Hollywood and Canada and stopping along the whole West Coast, doing either parts of films or an entire film in the Seattle area or the Portland area. And so there's quite a bit of business from smaller studios and also photo shoots. We get a lot of calls about photo shoots because of the scenicness of this area. It's so beautiful. I did a photo shoot a couple of years ago for Target doing camping gear, where they went out to Anacortes and set up all their tents and their sleeping bags under this backdrop of the water and the mountains, and it's such a beautiful area. So it's not as big as going up to Vancouver. It's not as big as going down to Hollywood, but it is. It's kind of a niche market, and there's definitely a good opportunity here for people working with animals on a smaller scale business.
So we're talking to Jordan Taylor. She wrote the book Wonder Dogs, 101 German Shepherd Dog Films. She's also a dog trainer for film, as she mentioned, photo shoots, as well as movies and TV shows, as well as plays, too. So let's talk about your book, your Wonder Dogs. I know you sent it to me, I don't know, dang near a month ago, I guess, and I read through it, and you know, I was amazed at how many movies that you have compiled in there, 101 of them. It's just kind of interesting that there are so many movies about German Shepherds themselves. Why did you take that particular breed? Because everybody knows that, you know, they're always in the films and things. So why did you concentrate on those guys?
I wanted to write this book because I wanted to read the book. I love German Shepherds. I love the films. I love the training. I'd been researching the history of movie dogs as part of my own education for film training, and I kept looking for a book like this. Everywhere I turned, there were stories about the German Shepherds in film. They were such big dogs, such a big part of film, not just Hollywood, but all over the world, and I kept looking for that resource, that book, you know, tell me more about these dogs. I want to know more about them from the early silent films, 1921 with Strongheart and Rin Tin Tin, up until today, still in releasing films starring German Shepherds. And finally, it dawned there is not one comprehensive resource like that about the breed, even though it's just such an incredible story to look at all these dogs. And so it was almost by accident that I started compiling all this information, and eventually was like, well, I could write that book. I've got all of these resources now, and had been at the time that I started working on the book, had been collecting the actual films for years. And I just wanted to see the book myself, and I thought, if I'm that interested in it, there must be some other people out there who would find it an engaging topic also and something that you would want to learn more about.
You know, it is quite interesting that, dogs have been in the film industry since literally the beginning, you know, in the early 20s,
yeah,
in the silent films and things. Why do you think that dogs are so popular in movies? Because a lot of times, and this is just kind of my perception of it, a lot of times people will gravitate towards the dog character much more than they will the human characters in the movie. Why do you think that is?
Well, historically, when dogs first started appearing in movies, nobody could speak. And that gave the dog such an edge. I think that's one reason the dog character in film and this idea of a dog hero who could carry a whole story and save the farm and save the kid and take care of everyone really came about because the dog was on really equal footing with the humans when it was all about the action and the appearance and, you know, getting that close-up and that face shot. A dog could do that almost as well as a human being if the dog was a skilled dog, a dog with charisma and had the trainer behind them to pull that off. And so it started very naturally where people started, oh, it was kind of a funny thing, you know, or it was, oh, there's, you know, it was a novelty item that you would see a dog being the star in a film. The first dog star was in England in 1905, and it was just a novelty thing. You know, it was a funny thing, but then the film became hugely popular, so much so that it actually degraded, and they had to remake the movie a couple of times because people just loved this dog. And so it came from this even footing of dog and person into, well, this is really something. This could really be an industry. And since that time, things have changed. Times have changed. You see a lot of, you know, computer-generated dogs doing stunt backup work now in films. And, of course, the people are talking. But we still have that bond and that connection with dogs as pet animals. And we still want to go to see them on the screen doing something that we're like, wow, that's so fun. It's so extraordinary, or maybe they're not doing something extraordinary, but we still identify with them. We have our own dogs at home, and we go when we're, you know, seeing, oh, that dog is so adorable. I get a lot of emails from people saying, what kind of dog was that in a movie? People notice the dog, even if it's in a background thing. It's something that people love to identify with.
Well, and you know, Jordan, everybody knows who Lassie is, and Lassie, I don't believe, has been on the air since, I guess, the late 50s, early 60s, but even my kids, who are teenagers, still would understand who that dog is. So my next question in regards to Lassie is pretty much a controversial question. Is the dogs that are in films all of a sudden become the most popular pets? For example, when 101 Dalmatians came out, everybody went out and bought a Dalmatian. And I remember when those movies first hit the screen, I was seeing a lot of Dalmatians coming into my training school wanting training. And the same goes with Golden Retrievers for movies like Homeward Bound and things like that. So what can you tell the public about that particular topic? Because I think that's a very important one. They see these very well-trained dogs, whether it's a collie like Lassie or a Golden Retriever or even a little Jack Russell Terrier like was in the movie, Frasier. Tell us about that. What can you tell our audience about these highly trained dogs versus the average pet?
It is a big problem, and it is hard when you go out to a movie and you see something like 101 Dalmatians or Air Bud, and you're like, that dog is just so fantastic. That would be the perfect dog for me, perfect dog for my family. But you're not getting the dog off of the movie. You're going and getting a dog that you don't know what it's like, and you don't know the background, and you haven't done your research, and it is a huge problem. As you're saying, St. Bernard's with Beethoven were a big one. And people need to be educated. People need to look into the dog they're getting and think about the dog they're getting. Movie studios now, like when Walt Disney released Beverly Hills Chihuahua a couple of years ago, have been putting disclaimers at the end of their films saying, do your research, don't go out and buy this dog just because you're seeing it in a movie. And while it's admirable of them to do that, it's still, I think, just a tiny chip on the iceberg to say that to people. It's really something that you need to repeat over and over and over for people to understand. And it is a big issue, I think. I have been seeing lately in my own business a lot of people moving towards using mixed breeds, which we love to see in the industry. Use mixed breeds, encourage people. Don't go out and get that purebred dog just because you saw it in a movie. Go to a shelter because you saw a dog in a movie. Do some research and look into a dog and get a mixed breed. Or if, and of course, there are purebred dogs in shelters too. How, whatever dog you get, do your research and don't think because you saw that dog in a film, it's going to be a great dog for your family, no matter what it was doing in the film. Whether it was sleeping on the couch or saving someone's life, that's not necessarily the dog you're bringing home.
Right. That's exactly right. We're talking to Jordan Taylor, the author of Wonder Dogs, and we're going to get right back to some questions in just a second. We do want to take a quick break, and then I want Michelle to kind of share her views of this. So we're going to be back in just a second. Can you hang on?
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back.
Whether you're a Schnauzer Shakespeare or a Hound Dog's Hemingway in the making, perk up your ears. Dog Works Radio is teaming up with animal chaplain Sid Corfee, author of the award-winning book, Good Grief, Finding Peace After Pet Loss, in presenting the Pulitzer Prize Contest, the Pet-Related Writer's Pulitzer. Animal lovers can showcase their creative writing abilities for nifty awards and for the chance to have their works read live on Dog Works Radio. Categories range from poetry to short stories to persuasive essays and more. For more information, visit the blog page at www.goodgriefpetloss.com and click on the Pulitzer Prize link.
And we are back. We're talking to Jordan Taylor, the author of Wonder Dogs. She's also a animal trainer for dogs and other pets in movies. She's calling in from the Seattle, Washington area, and I do want to apologize to our listeners real quick for the long pause. That's what we're doing when we're dealing with internet radio, so I do apologize with that. Michelle, do you have a question for Jordan?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a question or just some observations and statements about our topic today, which seems to be dogs in movies. I think that her book is a fantastic resource for people, especially, you know, as we were just speaking about researching the proper pet for your home, not just becoming totally enthralled by the dog that you saw on a movie. You know, those dogs go through hundreds of hours of training. They're typically not puppies. And that's where a lot of people get drawn in, thinking that the dog's not only cute, but that they'll be getting this fabulous dog because they saw it on a movie or you know, even a cartoon rendition of a dog breed has the potential to have people go out and get those particular breeds. And a lot of things that I'm observing is these designer breeds that are out there right now, they're still mutts. We're seeing a lot of them come through here in Denver. But not only that, but I don't think it just should be, you know, that you saw a dog on a movie or a television show. Sometimes when you see one of those starlets carrying one around, you know, the next thing I know, I've got five Yorkshire Terriers and seven Chihuahuas because so-and-so had one in their purse. So I think that people really do need to take a step back and research the type of pet that will fit into their home properly. You know, it's not always the right fit going through the shelter any more than it is going through the breeder or a pet store. Sometimes a dog is just not the right fit for you and your lifestyle, and a lot of times that's what people seem to forget. They get caught up in the fad of, well, everyone I know has a dog, so I think I should get one too.
Yeah.
Jordan, you care to respond to that?
I think that's exactly right, and it's a great point. Even though I've written a whole book about German Shepherds in movies, I don't even have a German Shepherd because of my lifestyle right now. It would just not be a good fit for a German Shepherd, as much as I love the breed and always have. I have smaller dogs right now, and I think that's something people do need to think about, that all too often they don't. Is it the right dog? What's that dog going to be like? Should you even have a dog right now? Maybe later on. Maybe now's not a good time for a dog. Maybe it's not a good situation right at this minute. And really think about that, because people don't think enough about the commitment of a dog, like having a child, that dog is going to be with you for 10, 12, 15, 16 years, and what you need to do to be prepared to take that on in your life and not look at, you know, the dog in the purse with the celebrity, the dog on screen that's doing an adorable trick, and think, oh, I wish I had one of those.
Those are great points, and I think that's leading into right into the subject that I want to talk about is how these dogs get to be the dogs that we see on the film. You know, in today's day and age, I guess from about Beethoven era forward, they've changed the way that dogs are interacting these days. They put in the speaking parts and all that sort of stuff that for 75, 80 years they didn't do. They did dog stuff. So before we get into the training aspect, what do you think about that, Jordan, about the, you know, these speaking dogs that they have, you know, where they, you know, they manipulate the graphics and things where they get the dogs to have speaking roles? What can you tell us about that?
I think it's a phenomenon that's really related to the progression of cinema and technology in general, where even 20, 30 years ago, people were very happy to see a dog being a dog. Now when they release, especially a children's film, everything is above and beyond. Everything is more up, more Hollywood, more extravagant, more special effects. And so my feeling about the dogs and anthropomorphizing dogs in films, so they're talking or they're doing karate moves or whatever it is the dog is doing, is just in keeping with progression of cinema as far as a Hollywood sense, because you don't see that so much with other countries, but definitely here with the bigger studios, just about every dog movie that comes out now, the dog is either talking or it has expressions that are computer generated or doing something that is not dog-like. And my feeling is that's just in keeping with the development in cinema overall, that everything we do with films now with the bigger studios is sort of above and beyond and a little outside of our reality to make it that much more appealing for us, and why we want to see a movie and it's different and it's something that you don't see in your day-to-day life.
Well, even with the computer-generated voices and expressions, those dogs still have to be very well trained. You know, dogs are going to be dogs. So they have to be able to perform on cue, whether it's just laying on the couch or, you know, sitting beside their co-star or master or whatever we want to call them. They still have to be very well-trained animals. So my next question is, what characteristics do dogs need to have to be good performers? And can you explain how the different breeds are looked upon for particular roles?
When I look at a dog for consideration to train with or work with, I look at things that are similar to what you might look for in a young service dog. I want a dog that is, above all, not fearful and not aggressive. I can work with other things. I can work with hyper. I can work with a dog that's just laid back and not paying much attention. I can work with a dog with really high drive, kind of moderate drive, but mostly a dog that is even keeled. I need a dog that if a light falls over on the set, it's not going to panic. I need a dog that if a child runs up to it on the set, it's not going to snap. And so really a dog that has this temperament that can work with people, be around people, work all day, and still be a settled, stable dog and not be anxious or aggressive at any time with people. As far as the different breeds, I would start with the basics of this sort of foundation, no matter what dog you look at. And then you're going to go role by role as far as your other qualities. You know, what does this role demand? Do they want the dog laying on the couch? Do they want the dog catching a frisbee? And so you'll look at whatever breed they want and whatever qualities they want and say, well, you know, maybe the director wants to have a poodle in the shot, but they're wanting it to jump in the air and catch a frisbee, and really you have a border collie that is perfect for that, but your poodle's not going to do that. And so you say, well, would you want to work with the border collie? And you try to accommodate them as well as you can while also getting the best dog for the job. And there is a lot of training. Even if you see a shot where the dog is laying on the couch, that was a lot of training. That dog had to go to a mark, and it has to stay there for it. And you see a lot of, especially little things like commercials, where the casual observer leaves with the feeling that that dog was just sort of there doing that naturally. And I can tell you from experience, the more natural it looks and the more laid back the dog looks and the more easy it looks, the harder it was to teach the dog to do it.
You know, we have a question coming in on the chat room, Jordan. Then the question is how do dogs get paid and what is the typical amount for the different areas, you know, movies, commercials, photo shoots, et cetera? I know it ranges widely, but can you give us a ballpark?
Oh, that's a good question, and it is a huge range that you're going to see. In the Pacific Northwest and working up in Canada, you're going to have a lower pay scale compared to being in Hollywood and working with larger studios. For a photo shoot or just a small independent production here, we don't usually charge more than $150 to $250 a day. And that's just working with the small-scale people. You're going to go up and up and up as you're going into bigger productions, more professional productions, and higher demands on the dog. If you are working with months and months of advanced training, and then you're there all day, every day, and you have a team with you, you're going to be getting into more multiple hundreds a day to work with multiple trainers, multiple dogs, and have a larger production team. But it really does vary very widely.
You know, this is kind of a sarcastic, goofy question, but do dogs have a union or a guild like the actors do? What if it's just something that the dog, in particular the owner, doesn't want their dog to do?
Well, there is a society, the American Humane Association Film and TV Unit, that works to protect animals, dogs, and other animals in the film industry and monitor films to make sure the dog is not being abused, the dog is not being asked to do anything dangerous or other animals. They work with all animals. And unfortunately, that is the only program of that kind in the world. There are no organizations, no worldwide laws protecting animals in film. And it is at the filmmaker's discretion whether or not they want to work with the American Humane Association, which is too bad, because it would be nice to think there are more laws in place. There is something like, you say, a guild, maybe not a guild for the dogs, but a guild for the trainers, or a guild that has some ethical responsibility attached to it, because as it is right now, the laws protecting performing animals, not only in this country but all over the world, are very sketchy. They're very so-so and not really set in stone where there are a large body of people working to protect the animals. It's really a very small group of people out there.
So with that, are there things that you would refuse to ask a dog to do for a particular shoot, whether that be for a photo shoot or for film or play?
Absolutely. And since there are so few monitoring agencies out there, and especially when you're working on a small shoot or just a photo shoot or a little commercial, anything small, you're going to be there with your dog alone. You are your dog's only advocate, and you need to take that very, very seriously, because that's first and foremost, that's what matters. We try to get the shot. We try to do everything we can do to accommodate the director. But there are things that, you know, people want you to do, and you have to explain, he can't do that. Maybe it's jumping in a river. And maybe you have one dog that's a really strong swimmer, but he can't jump in right there, and he needs to go further downstream. And they're like, well, you know, the water doesn't look as good further downstream, but you've got to put your foot down sometimes and say, no, he can't jump in at this point. You've got to go further downstream because it's just too dangerous. And it can be just little tiny things. Mostly, they're great. The people that I've worked with, the directors, the photo crews, they're wonderful. Nobody is trying to hurt your dog. But you do need to be your dog's advocate. Anyone out there who's thinking about getting their dog into foam work, you are your dog's advocate, and you need to protect them because often you're the only one there for them.
You know, that's a great point, Jordan. We're talking to Jordan Taylor, author of Wonder Dog. She is also a trainer for dogs in film. You mentioned dogs jumping into rivers and things like that. I know a lot of the films use multiple dogs. I know in Beethoven in particular, they used 8 or 9 St. Bernards to play the one character of Beethoven. What can you tell us about that?
That's very common if you're going to have a demanding role. If you see a dog that has, you know, one guest starring appearance on a TV show or a dog that's in a movie that's kind of in a background role, it's probably only one dog. It is an extra challenge and an extra cost for production if you need to train and bring in multiple dogs. But once you get up to the films like Beethoven and Beverly Hills Chihuahua, Cats and Dogs, these more recent films, those are all going to have multiple dogs playing a single role. There's usually a face dog, a dog that you will do your close-ups on, and so you keep that consistent expression face look where the audience can recognize a certain dog, and then you might have a dog who does all the running shots so that you don't tire out your face dog, and a dog who maybe is a good climber or can catch things. And it just, you'll go up and up depending on how demanding your shoot is until, like you say, you can end up with a role like Marley and Me, in that the recent movie where they had about 13 dogs. But, of course, that dog was going from puppy to adult to old age also. So that's a whole special thing when you're actually aging the dog and you have all kinds of dogs all throughout the shoot coming in. But then there's this one core face dog who is really your star.
You know, I know people are thinking about this as we're talking. So a great question to ask is, are the owners allowed on these sets, whether it be a photo shoot or a play or even a movie? And if they are, how do you deal with that distraction?
That really depends. I have usually worked without the owners there. And with my own dogs, of course, I work with like a little circle of dogs that are privately owned and then my own as well. And it depends on the dog and it depends on the owner. If the dog is going to be clingy and be like, oh, I just need to sit with mom right now, that's not going to work for us. But if the owner is very in tune with the dog, very good with the training, and you have worked together, there's no reason that doesn't work out. With the larger companies who are training, who actually have multiple trainers working and are doing the larger films, they use dogs often that are privately owned that will come and board with them. And so the owner may or may not see the dog during that time, but the owner would certainly not be on the set. I think that would be an exception rather than a rule that you would be there. And so you would definitely want to have a relationship with that trainer to begin with and know, you know, where is the dog living, how are they being taken care of, how long is it going to take, because the filming will have a schedule and they should be able to answer all of those questions. What are the training methods? You know, watch them work and stuff and make sure you feel comfortable before you would let your dog go and stay with them. But it is pretty common that we work, even myself with a small company, but especially the larger companies, will work with privately owned dogs, train them up for the shoot, do the shoot, and then they go back home.
So you were talking about the differences between photo shoots and movies and theater. A year or so ago, a company was producing a show, a live performance run in Denver, and they called us up looking for a particular dog for a particular part. It was the first dog in space is what they were looking for, and they had very particular parameters that they were looking for when they called us up, and we just didn't have that available. How difficult is it for you guys to work with directors and producers, and they have this idea in mind, you know, they want this particular look for this particular part or whatever, and that may not be available. How difficult is it to find dogs that kind of set the tone for particular projects?
That's a good question. It is absolutely a big concern. My favorite kind of director or producer is the one who will contact me saying, we need a dog around this size who can do this. But that's not often what happens. Usually they do come to you with a look or a breed that they want, a specific type of dog. And so then your goal first and foremost is to find a dog with the look, but then you've also got to take into account the personality. Because just because you can find a dog that looks like, you know, the first dog in space doesn't mean that's going to be the perfect personality. Maybe you find the great dog, but the dog is scared. Maybe the dog has other things. The dog is a barker. You can't take the dog on stage. And so it is a huge challenge. And the majority of calls that we turn down, because we only take so much percentage of the business that we get because we are a very small company, are because of just not having that exact perfect dog. And so we refer people on to other trainers. It's absolutely a big issue. The really large trainers have so many resources. I think they're prepared to say, okay, we need this dog, and we need it to do this, we need it to look like this, and they make it happen. But when you're a smaller business, it's definitely something that you can't provide every single dog all the time.
And that's exactly right. You know, I think people contact me via email at least once or twice a month looking for a dog for a photo shoot, and they'll write me on Monday, and they say, okay, we need this Chihuahua, pit bull, whatever it is for this particular photo shoot, but they need them by Wednesday to do
mm-hmm.
this photo shoot. And I don't think a lot of these guys, I think in the photography industry in particular, they have no idea what has to go into this just to get the dog prepared to do something as simple as, you mentioned, a target photo shoot. You just can't have your run-of-the-mill house dog, you know, show up on a photo shoot set and be ready to go in a couple of days.
Yes. Yeah, last-minute calls are definitely a big thing. Photo shoots specifically, as you mentioned, getting the call 1 or 2 days before, sometimes 24 hours before, saying, can we have a litter of puppies? You know, like, no, sorry. We can't always get you a litter of puppies 24 hours before, especially a specific breed of a litter of puppies. And so it is something that you, as the trainer, as someone who's working with the producers and who's showing up on the set, you often find yourself in a position of educating people as subtly as you can to try and explain, you know, what the dog can do, what the dog can't do, that the dog has its limits. And there was a case, I know a woman who was on a photo shoot set with a Norfolk Terrier, and the photographer, they did some shots, and the photographer's not really happy with them, and he said, can you make him make his ears stand up? And so you get bizarre requests like that where the people genuinely think that the dog is trained on command to make his floppy ears stand up. And so you have to work with people the best you can and accommodate them the best you can, and also in certain situations explain, you know, I'm sorry, we just can't do that.
Right, right. And you mentioned theater versus film. Is it more difficult to work in that medium versus the other?
It is. I mean, they both have their different challenges. The thing about the theater and live performances is that you can't do takes. And so the dog goes out. You're not with the dog. You can't go on stage with them. And they have to do it right the first time, and they have to do it over and over every night or during the day and then at night, however many shows you're doing. And a big, big difference with the film work versus theater work is that you need to teach the actor to work with the dog. When you're in movie sets, you are always there. You're always coaching the dog, always being able to show it what to do, even if it's at a great distance. You prep it, you rehearse it, the dog is responding to you, not the actor. Even if it looks like they're responding to the actor, they're not. They're responding to their trainer. But when you go into a theater situation, that actor has to bond with the dog and give the dog the hand signals and get the dog to work with them. So first you have to go in, train the dog, get the dog to do the hand signals, then train the actor, get them to do them, get everyone in key, and then give those people, the dog and the actor, a decent amount of time to bond and work together before the show, so it is definitely a whole set of challenges on its own and quite a different thing from working in the films.
Sounds great. Michelle, do you have another point to make before we get into the book in particular?
No, I think it's very educational, what everything that she's going over. I mean, we have a lot of clients that ask us about, you know, their dogs doing this type of work, and I'm always the first to say, you know, hold up, wait a second. You already have a full-time job. You don't have the money to hire a trainer. Denver is not a mecca for this type of work. We do not have a lot of trainers that go around and, you know, have a list of clientele dogs that they can say, oh, yes, I have, you know, this dog available for this film. We just don't have it here. You know, they just don't do that type of work. So for this area, I mean, even though Denver is a major dog-friendly city, metropolitan area, this is phenomenal to me because it just you just have a lot of people interested in doing it that have no idea that they need to move to Los Angeles or New York or places mm-hmm. like that. And it becomes not only a full-time job, but you're basically spending your entire day hustling down jobs for your dog to do. And you know what? Your dog may not ever like to do any of it.
That's a good point. What happens if the dog is just, you know, you've got him on the set, you've hired him, and, you know, you're into production, and the dog just refuses to work? How do you deal with that, Jordan?
You find another dog if you can match them, or you just make it as simple for them as you can, and you just cut everything back and explain, you know, he's not going to do that, but how about this? Make it easy as you can on him and don't work with the dog again. Because there are dogs that will start out great and then maybe they're like, I don't know, you know, it's been a rough week, I'm not feeling up to it. So instead of the scene where they jump onto the couch and spin in circles and they're playing with their toy, you say, well, can he just be laying on the couch so you can get him in the scene? And you keep it low key for the dog and let the dog just have his moment where he can sit there, he can go to his mark, he can get his reward, it's all great, it's all really upbeat for them, and you're really excited that they did a good job, and they're like, okay, yeah, this is not so bad, and the dog can relax on the set, and then you, if you can, bring in another dog. That's another thing about having multiple dogs playing one role, is that if you have a dog where you get there one day and the dog is just like not feeling it, you bring in another dog, and that dog can take the place. And it is something that people should think about who are interested in getting their dogs into the work. Just because your dog has an adorable face that stops traffic doesn't mean that it's a working dog, that it's a working dog personality, because that's one reason the German Shepherds have been hugely successful in films, is that this is a dog with so much drive that just wants to work, 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 work. And so if you have a gorgeous dog that does some tricks, that doesn't mean it's a working dog that is going to go out and say, you know, what do you want me to do? Okay, now what do you want me to do? And just keep working for you and be excited to be there. It is. It's a really big concern, both your personality and your dog's personality.
We're talking to Jordan Taylor. She is the author of Wonder Dogs, 101 German Shepherd Dog Films. And I'm just amazed that there are that many films that include a German Shepherd. I'm a huge movie buff, and I love to watch all sorts of movies. And of course, I, as a dog trainer, I always look for the films with dogs in them. So, Jordan, before we get into your book and some questions about that, how do people purchase your book? Do you write a blog about it? You know, tell us some particulars.
You can get the book online. It's on Amazon.com. BarnesandNoble.com, and it's also on DogWise. DogWise, of course, is a fantastic resource for dog books. I'd love to go and look at all their books, so that's DogWise.com also. And I have a movie dog blog that's not specifically about the book, but is just about dogs in movies in general, and that is RealDogs@Blogspot.com, and it's REEL, dogs, at blogspot.com. And you can see more information about the book on there and on the websites on Amazon.com. There are reviews for it where you can find out more about it.
And I found you by YouTube. You have a YouTube video up. How do you search for that?
There is a book trailer for Wonder Dogs. If you want to go to YouTube and just put in Wonder Dogs or Wonder Dogs 101, it will come up. It's the Wonder Dogs book trailer. And it features a gorgeous German Shepherd. It's worth watching just to see the dog, if I may say so. He's just beautiful. Eddie, who played Prince in the trailer, and you can see that on there. That trailer's on the blog, too, and it's also on my website. You can see it on there.
So in your book about German Shepherds, you talk about Rin Tin Tin. What can you tell us about him and his or hers, I don't even know if it's a male or a female, lineage today?
Rin Tin Tin was the second German Shepherd star after Strongheart pioneered that in 1921, and then Rin Tin Tin had his first star in film in 1923. A lot of people are familiar with the Adventures of Rin Tin Tin TV show, and that's how Rin Tin Tin is still remembered today, especially by baby boomers and their children, with reruns of Rin Tin Tin, and that's what people think about. But the original Rin Tin Tin was actually a puppy abandoned after a bombing in World War I, and he was brought back to the States by an American soldier, Lee Duncan, who trained Rin Tin Tin and got him into films with Warner Brothers. He's been credited with saving the Warner Brothers studio from bankruptcy, because
wow,
his films were so popular, and it really helped to launch them. And so there's a question about that. Would we even have a Warner Brothers movie studio today if it wasn't for Rin Tin Tin? Then he went on, Rin Tin Tin Jr., his sons and grandsons, they went on to do more films through the 40s, and then the TV show, which is the best remembered, I think, Rin Tin Tin today. And there is also still the Rin Tin Tin lineage is going on, and that's in Crockett, Texas. You can visit rintintin.com and see all about them. They've got a great breeding program there. They raise dogs for service dogs and therapy dogs that are all part of the Rin Tin Tin lineage. You can also get a Rin Tin Tin dog as a pet, but it is, I believe, it's a pretty extensive waiting period and a big questionnaire to do that. But visit them at rintintin.com, and you can see they have appearances off and on and tons of pictures and information about the dogs, and just beautiful, beautiful dogs. The Rin Tin Tin line that has still gone strong today, it's really wonderful to see them, that they're still out there and taking care of that breed.
You know, that's a great point about the generations. Often in any type of working dog, that generational background is so important. In the sled dog world, we often base our next race, whether it's 2 or 3 years down the line, on the dogs that we have today and the lineage that they have today. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. I think everybody thinks, and this isn't to downgrade a typical pet owner, but most people think that every golden retriever is going to be just like the golden retriever that they owned when they were a child or that, you know, they saw on the TV show or whatever. And it's not. It comes from that lineage. And in Rin Tin Tin's case, it's many generations back. Can you mention that just a little bit?
Yes, it is interesting, and you do see that with the earlier movie dogs, the cases of Rin Tin Tin and Strongheart, and then other dogs who were famous at that time, too, when you would read the press books or articles about them, frequently talking about their breeding program, their puppies, you know, what was going on with that dog, what tours they were making where you could see them or their puppies in an article. And I think it was a big thing at that time. Dogs could be much more famous in and of themselves at that time than you see now. And a dog doing a big national tour who was a famous movie dog was a fairly common thing, say in the 20s and 30s. And it was a big deal. The lineage of the dog, the kennel that the dog came from, you'd hear it just mentioned off and on, where now when you see a dog in a movie, you don't really hear that much about it. And there are also a lot of rescue dogs in movies, which is fantastic that you do hear people say and that they came from a shelter. But this the idea of the lineage was very alive and well in the movies, and dogs would go on where they would continue for years and years marketing the dog on their posters and their press material as the grandson of so-and-so or the son of so-and-so or even the great-grandson of Rin Tin Tin. They did a huge movie poster with the top header of the poster said the great-grandson of Rin Tin Tin. And so it was a very big deal at the time. Not as much so now, you don't really see it, but it is nice to see that there are still people preserving these old lines of dogs that are wonderful, beautiful dogs.
So in your book, you talk about 101 different movies that included a German Shepherd. Did you get a chance to watch all of those in your research?
Just about. There are a couple of movies in the book that I did not get to see. One is the very earliest film, which was definitely a challenge with those early silent films. Now, only about 10 to 15% of all silent films around the world still survive today, which is really sad that you can't see all of the work, not just from dog movies, but everyone at that time, any researchers looking into these films. There just are not a whole lot out there. But I did manage to see almost all the films. There were about half a dozen in the book that I didn't get to. And there was one specifically, a film from Denmark, that I was able to get a copy of the film, but it didn't have English subtitles. And fortunately, I'd read the book that it was based on. So you can kind of put together everything, you know, the story and what's going on, read the book and then watch the film and sort of fill it in your head. You know what they're saying.
So in your book, of course, you're talking about German Shepherds. A lot of people, and this is kind of getting off the point just a little bit, but a lot of people have this particular look for a German Shepherd. They think that all the German Shepherds look like one particular type. And, of course, there's a big difference, I'm sure you know, as well as Michelle and I do, as owning one of these European line German Shepherds. They're a lot different dog than the American Shepherd, aren't they?
Yes, and there is one of the things I love about the German Shepherd movies is that they are so international. And you can go through the list of films in the book and pick out movies where you can see dogs represented from bloodlines all over the world, not just the European and American dogs, but Canadian dogs, dogs from China, dogs from Israel, and dogs in the UK. You can see all of these types and see, watching these films, that there are such an array of dogs that are beautiful and very different in how they look and how they come across and also how they behave. A dog, you know, of one type might be much more high-strung and running around with the actors, where another dog is just kind of goofy and hanging out and a lot more mellow with the people. And you really can see that in just the array of dogs. And also in the timeline, watching the films of what the German Shepherd dog looked like in the 1920s and 1930s, compared to today, it really is a huge transition in what the breed looked like and currently looks like in all different places around the world.
You know, we only have a few minutes left, Jordan. We're talking to Jordan Taylor, author of Wonder Dogs. I want to talk about one movie in particular before we close here, one of probably the most endearing in terms of the dog-human relationship in recent memory in terms of German Shepherds, and that's the movie I Am Legend with Will Smith and the German Shepherd that plays a huge role in the movie. As a history buff of these types of movies as well as the German Shepherd, what can you tell us about I Am Legend?
That's a movie that I've heard so much from people about being, I don't want to spoil it for people if they haven't seen the movie, but bad things happen to the dog, and there's just an outpouring about that film that people couldn't believe it and were so upset about the things that they did in that movie. And it is such a relationship movie because you have this man who is the only man that really carries the entire film, that is the only man in the world as far as we know, and his one companion is a German Shepherd. And it's really a remarkable film to watch the interaction with them. It was a film in the train. I said before that we don't really have the dog bond with the actor in the films. It's more of a stage thing. But this was a film where they really did have the dog bond and spent a lot of time with Will Smith beforehand. Abby played Samantha in the film, and she was she's still living in Hollywood, a gorgeous, gorgeous dog, and they really managed to pull off an extraordinary relationship with them and bring it across so well with things that were so subtle. The dog looking so relaxed, the dog just walking around with him, and it really is a fantastic film to see the training and the work that went into this relationship with the dog, and is one that people over and over I've heard stuff from saying, you know, that they can't believe the way things turned out with them. But if you just look at it from the standpoint of the dog work and the relationship to bring across in the film, it really is a fantastic story. And Will Smith, at the end of the filming, actually offered to buy Abby. He wanted to keep her, and the trainers declined. And she's still at the, we're still living with the trainers in Hollywood. But it was really an amazing relationship that they pulled off.
So if you haven't seen it yet, make sure you go to Netflix or Blockbuster or whatever and check out I Am Legend. It's a 2 or 3 year old movie. I don't know, 4 or 5 year old movie now. But that encompasses exactly what we've been talking about the entire hour, that relationship that dogs have with people in film, way back from 1905, as Jordan mentioned, all the way up through the recent times. I think that's one of the films that will really capture what we're talking about. Michelle, do you have a final question for Jordan?
No, I think that it's just a wonderful topic that we've covered today, and I hope that it enlightens people and educates them to what their dog can do and cannot do.
That's a great point to make, what they can and cannot do, and also for people that are looking for particular dogs for photo shoots or movies or plays or anything like that. Jordan, are you working on anything else these days? What's going on?
I'm working on other books now, but mostly fiction. I actually writing novels, so hopefully
about dogs?
Some dogs in there too, both. So
okay.
You can hopefully expect to see another dog book from me at some point. And you can watch me on my website, and I'm on Facebook with all the different book stuff.
We do a lot of author interviews, so if you have something coming out in the near future, keep us in mind, because we love to talk about it, and we love to promote other folks. So keep us in mind. If you do have something else coming out, we'd be happy to have you back on. So one more time, Jordan, how do people find your book? Where do they read about you and things like that?
You can find the book on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, DogWise.com. Check out the RinTinTin.com website for more information about him. You can find me at JordanTaylorBooks.com. And there's also on my website, on my nonfiction page, where you'll find Wonder Dogs, there's a link to a list of even more German Shepherd movies. If you're looking for something to put on your Netflix list, you can go on there. There's a total of over 450 German Shepherd movies listed on my website. So a fun resource for people looking for a great dog movie.
JordanTaylorBooks.com. The lady cut us out there. JordanTaylorBooks.com and RealDogs.com, I believe it is, right? RealDogs, R-E-E-L, dogs.com. Jordan, it's been a pleasure. We'll keep in touch, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Thank you very much. This is Robert Forto on behalf of Michelle. We will see you guys next week. It'll be round 4, I believe, of the Pulitzer Prize. That will be on Friday at 2 o'clock Mountain Time. Michelle, would you like to close for us?
Never forget your dreams and always continue to do what's best for you and your dog, and understand that sometimes what you want to do with your dog isn't necessarily what your dog's capable of doing.
There you go. So this is DogWorks Radio, part of Twine Group Media. We'll talk to you guys real soon. Goodbye.